Welcome back, my fellow creatives, to You've Got 5 Pages to Tell Me It's Good, where I grab a new release from my local library to see if this book can indeed, in 5 pages, tell me it's good. So I have something that looked rather promising. It's David Gran. Gran? We're going to go with Grant, writer of Killers of the Flower Moon, which is now a Scorsese film. So kudos for him. But this one is something a bit different. This one is called The Wager, a tale of shipwreck, mutiny, and murder. And as one who does enjoy a good nautical explore, as it were, a good nautical story, I'm excited about this because, I mean, one of my favorite, one of my favorite films is the Russell Crowe film, Master and Commander. I find the Regency period, well, this isn't technically Regency, because this is a bit older than that, 1742 here, but we are dealing with a unique period where exploration, where shipbuilding, where technology is nowhere near what a modern day audience would consider technology. So just the concept of information moving so very slowly, of people moving so very slowly, and yet events still happening in real time, but unable to allay that information with others. I don't even know if I use that word correctly. I'm just going to keep going. I find that all very fascinating. You know, so I am excited to see how David Gran shares the story of The Wager, which deals with, they bring up Patrick O'Brien. That's very nice of them. But yes, this is based on, I just want to make sure that I am looking at this correctly. Oh, no wonder. This guy knows his Sherlock Holmes too. Well, then that, and an Edgar Allan Poe Award winner. Okay, so we are dealing with someone who knows how to craft, paste mystery narrative, so knows how to drop certain elements to compel a reader to keep reading, knows how to balance clue work and red herring work in order to propel the mystery without losing a reader. So that's awesome. So I'm stoked. So let's tuck into this. I'm gonna get forward here. It would help if I'm looking at the right stuff. You're all fine. Okay. There we go. I'm sorry, I was just glancing at the author's note. I wanna read this because this, and then we have a prologue. And then we finally get to different perspectives. Okay. So author's note, I must confess that I did not witness the ship strike the rocks or the crew tie up the captain, nor did I see firsthand the acts of deceit and murder. I have, however, spent years combing through the archival debris, the washed-out logbooks, the moldering correspondence, the half-truthful journals, the surviving records from the troubling court-martial. Most critically, I have studied the accounts published by those who were involved, who not only witnessed the events, but also shaped them. I tried to gather all the facts to determine what really happened. Still, it's impossible to escape the participants' conflicting and at times warring perspectives. So instead of smoothing out every surface, So instead of smoothing out every difference or further shading the already shaded evidence, I've tried to present all sides, leaving it to you to render the ultimate verdict. History's judgment. That was just a fun little author's note right there. I wasn't expecting that. And what's very interesting about this author's note, and I am just looking at the wealth of references in the back. My goodness. Well, Gran knows how to research. I'm going to give him that right now. My word. Okay. No, what I love about this author's note, gosh, I sound very gushy right now, but it's true, because how often do we sit and look at the author's note, right? And yet, Gran uses the author note to drop all this foreshadowing, like, look what's coming. It's like a preview, a trailer of the book to come. I mean, so how often does that happen with an author's note? I appreciate that. One paragraph, and I'm just waiting, like, I tell me more. Now, of course, we have a prologue. Because of course we do. Now, last week we had a really good prologue and first chapter start with Distant Suns. So I'm hoping we will have a similar situation here, where the prologue does a bang-up job of establishing and building momentum that the first chapter can hopefully continue. Because one of my biggest pet peeves as a picky reader is when the prologue hooks me, lures me in, but then the first chapter is just an absolute slamming of the brakes when it comes to momentum, when it comes to plot, when it comes to just story in general. Hate that. So I'm really hoping we do not have that here. Let's see what happens. Prologue. The only impartial witness was the sun. For days it watched as the strange object heaved up and down in the ocean, tossed mercilessly by the wind and the waves. Once or twice the vessel nearly smashed into a reef, which might have ended our story. Yet somehow, whether through destiny, as some would later proclaim, or dumb luck, it drifted into an inlet off the southeastern coast of Brazil, where several inhabitants laid eyes upon it. Above 50 feet long and 10 feet wide, it was a boat of some sort, though it looked as if it had been patched together from scraps of wooden cloth and then battered into oblivion. Its sails were shredded, its boom shattered. Seawater seeped through the hull and the stench emanated from within. The bystanders, edging closer, heard unnerving sounds. 30 men were crammed on board, their bodies almost wasted to the bone. Their clothes had largely disintegrated. Their faces were enveloped in hair, tangled and salted like seaweed. Some were so weak they could not even stand. One soon gave out his last breath and died. But a figure who appeared to be in charge rose with an extraordinary exertion of will and announced that they were castaways from His Majesty's ship, the Wager, a British man of war. When the news reached England, it was greeted with disbelief. In September 1740, during an imperial conflict with Spain, the Wager, carrying some 250 officers and crew, had embarked from Portsmouth in a squadron on a secret mission to capture a treasure-filled Spanish galleon known as, quote-unquote, the prize of all the oceans. Near Cape Horn, at the tip of South America, the squadron had been engulfed by a hurricane, and the Wager was believed to have sunk with all its souls. But 283 days after the ship had last been reported seen, these men miraculously emerged in Brazil. They had been shipwrecked on a desolate island off the coast of Patagonia. Most of the officers and crew had perished, but 81 survivors had set out in a makeshift boat lashed together partly from the wreckage of the Wager. Packed so tightly on board that they could barely move, they traveled through menacing gales and tidal waves, through ice storms and earthquakes. More than 50 men died during the arduous journey, and by the time the few remnants reached Brazil 3.5 months later, they had traversed nearly 3,000 miles, one of the longest castaway voyages ever recorded. They were hailed for their ingenuity and bravery. As the leader of the party noted, it was hard to believe that, quote-unquote, human nature could possibly support the miseries that we have endured. Now I'm going to pause there, first of all, because there's a section break. Second of all, I mean, obviously we are not in a specific narrative yet. This is all exposition to give us some context for what on earth we're getting into. And it's very well written. There's a lot of sensory detail, really, even though we're being told it like a newspaper account, essentially, only a bit deeper, I would say. And establishing a sense of time here is huge. The fact that these individuals were essentially MIA for nearly a year. A lot can happen in a year. A lot can happen in a very isolated space in the middle of harrowing elements of nature. And this first section, while initially sharing this, you know, the shock and awe of survival, there's definitely these undertones of, I'll say intrigue, because you want to know how on earth did they survive? And the fact that so many died, it makes one wonder what all happened. So let's keep going. 6 months later, another boat washed ashore, this one landing in a blizzard off the southwestern coast of Chile. It was even smaller. A wooden dugout propelled by a sail stitched from the rags of blankets. On board were three additional survivors, and their condition was even more frightful. They were half-naked and emaciated. Insects swarmed over their bodies, nibbling on what remained of their flesh. One man was so delirious that he had, quote-unquote, quite lost himself, as a companion put it, not recollecting our names or even his own. After these men recovered and returned to England, they leveled a shocking allegation against their companions who had surfaced in Brazil. They were not heroes. They were mutineers. In the controversy that followed, with charges and countercharges from both sides, it became clear that while stranded on the island, the Wager's officers and crew had struggled to persevere in the most extreme circumstances. Faced with starvation and freezing temperatures, they built an outpost and tried to recreate naval order. But as their situation deteriorated, the Wager's officers and crew, those supposed apostles of the Enlightenment, descended into an Hobbesian state of depravity. There were warring factions and marauders and abandonments and murders. A few of the men succumbed to cannibalism. Back in England, the principal figures from each group, along with their allies, were now summoned by the Admiralty to face a court-martial. The trial threatened to expose the secret nature not only of those charged, but also of an empire whose self-professed mission was spreading civilization. Several of the accused published their sensational and wildly conflicting accounts of what one of them called the quote-unquote dark and intricate affair. The philosophers Rousseau, Voltaire, and Montesquieu were influenced by reports of the expedition, and so later were Charles Darwin and two of the great novelists of the sea, Herman Melville and Patrick O'Brien. The suspect's main aim was to sway the Admiralty and the public. A survivor from one party composed what he described as a faithful narrative, insisting, quote, I have been careful not to insert one word of untruth, for falsities of any kind would be highly absurd in a work designed to rescue the author's character, unquote. The leader of the other side claimed in his own chronicle that his enemies had furnished an imperfect narrative and blackened us with the greatest calumnies. Well, there's a word I haven't used before. He vowed, quote, we stand or fall by the truth. If truth will not support us, nothing can, unquote. And we'll just finish out the prologue. We don't have time to even dive into the first chapter. We all impose some coherence, some meaning on the chaotic events of our existence. We rummage through the raw images of our memories, selecting, burnishing, erasing. We emerge as the heroes of our stories, allowing us to live with what we have done or haven't done. But these men believed their very lives depended on the stories they told. If they failed to provide a convincing tale, they could be secured to a ship's yardarm and hanged. End of prologue. And yes, part one, it looks like, yes, we are going to be getting into different perspectives, which makes sense, as we've been told in the prologue and author's note, we would be hearing from different members of the crew. So it is logical then that we are going to have multiple points of view in the coming novel. Now, as far as this prologue goes, I mean, it's very powerful. It's very compelling. And I am very intrigued because, again, diving into pieces of history, diving into how human nature reveals itself, not only in times of war, because this was definitely a conflict here, political, military conflict, diving into these times already, human nature gets just a bit nasty, just a smidge. But then when you throw in the conflict of nature, so it's not just man versus man, it's man versus nature, and it's man versus nature as it's impacted man, like Lord of the Flies. I mean, only those were children. That's part of what made that story so terrifying. We're watching supposed innocence devolve, essentially. And I noticed not just now, there's a little quote right before the author's note from Lord of the Flies. Maybe there is a beast. Maybe it's only us. And I think that's very fitting because clearly we're going to be getting into something of that here. I mean, if you are into historical fiction, I am sure, I shouldn't say historical fiction. David Grand was doing a lot of research. If you are into historical pieces, historical creative nonfiction, there we go. I think you're going to dig this, but you have to be prepared for the language of the period because obviously, the 1700s, you are getting into a whole new realm of what is considered normal, what is considered typical technology, typical slang that is completely out of touch with modern audiences today. And again, that's understandable. It's only been a couple of centuries. But that said, I mean, if you are not into period pieces, then I wouldn't try this. I really wouldn't. But if you do enjoy historical work, then tuck in, folks, because it looks like we're getting into a doozy here. I know I'm stoked because I love me a good historical mystery, nonfiction or fiction. And we'll see what I can find for next week then. So until then, read on, share on, and write on, my friends. Cheers.